My name is Sten Vermund. I am the director of the Institute for Global Health at Vanderbilt University. So I'm just a moderator, we are very pleased to have four terrific panelists. And I think the first one on the list is Carlos on the program. And I think you're loaded. So let me just introduce you first. Carlos Del Rio, I've known for a better part of 20 years, and Carlos, as a very young man, I think he was, 16, 17 years old, became the head of the Mexican CONACYTA. You know, he was running AIDS prevention and programs for the Ministry of Health and did a marvelous job. We all wonder whether Mexico's comparatively low HIV rates might have something to do with the programs that Carlos and his colleagues put into place a good 15 years ago, 25 years ago. It was a very pragmatic and aggressive response to the epidemic and quite visionary when it came to dealing with men who have sex with men. Very much counter the machismo stereotype culture. They have very pragmatic and aggressive programs. So after that, he was lured back to his alma mater at Emory, and he rose in the ranks at Grady Hospital, one of the largest public hospitals in the United States, to be the head of medicine, and carried Grady through some very dark fiscal days, and was finally lured to be the new head of global health, the Department of Global Health, at the Rollins School of Public Health at Emory University. So he's obviously from Mexico, a friend of Mexico, and is still deeply engaged in Mexico as director of the AIDS International Training and Research Program. He's also spearheading key trials in the AIDS in the HIV prevention trials unit. He's also been very involved in the ACTG and others. So without further ado, Carlos, you can, if you prefer, you can turn that on at the bottom, or you can use this.
Okay, thank you, Sten. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to you. How many are Spanish speakers? Put your hand up. Okay, English speakers. So we got to do a 50-50. This is going to be complicated. Anyway, the slides are in English. I speak in English fast. I speak in Spanish faster, so I'd rather do it in English. this is the result of some work that I've done in collaboration with Sergio Bautista, who's also here. And Sergio and I have been very interested in looking at migrant populations, and we come from a very different perspective, and I think this exemplifies global health. I'm, as Sten said, I train as a clinician, an infectious disease clinician. I then became an on-the-job trainee in public health when I started running the HIV program here in Mexico. I used to tell people I learned how to give pills, and now I'm having to learn how to distribute condoms. It's a totally different thing. But one of the things that you learn is that you don't know everything and you need to collaborate with people. So Sergio is an economist. You'll hear he's a health economist. And we decided that we wanted to look at we're both interested in migration and HIV. So we wanted to look at issues related to condom use among Mexican migrants in the U.S. because there's a lot of literature out there saying that Mexicans that go to the U.S. are more likely to use condoms. And our question was, is this due to self-selectivity? Is this acculturation or this availability? What are the reasons for this? This study was done, I point out to you, José Luis Figueroa here on ASP, but also Alex Tevez and Esteban González are both HR trainees of mine, so they got engaged in this research, and I think it was very helpful for them. So let me tell you a little bit about Hispanic immigration to the U.S. The U.S. Census Bureau estimates that there are about 31.7 million Hispanics in the U.S., which is about almost 12% of the total population, and about 20 million of those are of Mexican origin. And this roughly shows that. You got the people that are from Mexico, you have the other countries. You can't see very clear here, but that's Cuba, Puerto Rico, other Central American countries, and other Hispanics. So the great, great bulk of this is Hispanic. And again, this is the 2000 census. The 2010 census is ongoing right now, and we'll see what those data show once it's completed. So of those that more than 20 million people born in Mexico who live in the U.S., of which I am one of them, I'm also a minority. The great majority of them, 75% of them, are actually unauthorized to live in the United States. And between 1990 and 2000, North Carolina, Arkansas, Georgia, Tennessee, South Carolina, and Alabama had really the largest increase in Hispanic populations. you typically think about Chicago, and you think about LA, and you think about Texas. But really, it's the southeastern United States where there's really been a boom in immigration of Hispanics. And therefore, the idea was, I don't know why this is just keeps on changing by itself.
You can use the one underneath, I think.
Okay. Okay.
That might work better.
Therefore, we were interested in looking at the implications of migration on health of people and trying to understand that a little better between the two countries. And again, this just shows the number of Mexicans born who live in the United States and how rapidly that has increased. And this, again, when we... I don't know why this keeps on... It's alive, yeah. Yeah. Don't change it. Let me... No, it's like alive.
It must have the automatic...
And this is... You know, when you think about Mexico, Mexico is a gigantic country. So you need, you know, every time when I hear there's a migrant from Mexico, you really need to know from where. I mean, there's people that come, you know, as easy as Chihuahua. They just go to Ciudad Juarez, go across, about 3.5% of all migrants in the United States. But there's about 6% that come from Guerrero, about 8% from Michoacan. You see Oaxaca, Chiapas is not even here. So, and each one of them goes to different places where migration occurs and then goes to different places in the U.S. And Georgia, as I said, is the third fastest growing Hispanic population in any state and now has the 11th largest Hispanic population in the U.S. And 61% of Latinos in Georgia are 29 years of age or younger. Again, a lot of interest of why they could be significantly in, HIV may be a concern to them. And if you've never been to the border, this is the border, what it looks like. This is Mexico on this side, and you can see construction is all the way up to the border fence. This is the U.S. on this side, and as you can see, there's no construction there. Because those rows that you see right here is where the Border Patrol goes up and down and where they're monitoring and controlling people. But this is how people come across the border. They just jump over the fence. And once they get over the fence, and there's some people that actually just go there just to watch. This is almost like a sport. You can sit there and watch people jump across. And then there's certain people that go across, and they're distracting the Border Patrol while the real people are actually going on the other side. And the wall goes all the way into the ocean. Here are these people that actually, this is right south of San Diego, and you can see how the wall goes all the way out there. Enforcement of border control has really gone up in the United States, and you can see here the millions of dollars spent in border control. And I was hearing earlier on what was being talked about, you know, investment in security, et cetera, in one of the earlier talks. Well, you know, I think this is another thing that to talk about is what's this investment doing and what the consequences of it? Could we use that money more effectively? But I will tell you that they can make the walls bigger, the rates more frequent, the technology better, but migration will continue because essentially a law of supply and demand which determines the flow of migrants. And if you really want to stop immigration, you do what the U.S. has done this past year. You just make jobs really difficult to get. And basically the moment you screw up the U.S. economy, migration stops. I mean, it really puts a big dent in immigration. You close the number of employments, and immigration goes down. So the U.S., all they needed to do was really not to build a wall, just to mess up the U.S. economy, and that would take care of immigration. And I emphasize to you that one of the things that I worry about is that the U.S. likes immigration. They need immigration. We need these people to make sure that we can buy a head of lettuce for $1.19. And therefore, what I tell people is that, you know, the la mano de obra in America, what America wants is the hand. They don't want the worker. They just want the hand to do the work. And I think this is one of the big paradigms in America. You know, everybody wants the work, they want the hand, but they don't want the entire worker. And I think the entire body. And I think this is something that really the U.S. has to realize, that in order to have those cheap jobs, unfortunately, you can't just get hands, you've got to get the whole body. Well, immigration and HIV. In Mexico, HIV prevalence is low among the general population. It's 0.3% in people between 15 and 49 years of age. Heterosexual transmission is rising, and what's interesting, it is rising in areas where there's migration to the U.S. is common. And in rural areas, new HIV infections are almost always attributed to migration or linked to migration. I wouldn't say attributed. And what you see is that the male-to-female ratio, if you go to Mexico City, there's a lot more men than women. It's a very much of a male MSM epidemic. If you go to rural Mexico, it's much more like a heterosexual epidemic and really linked to migration. When you go to the U.S., the U.S. prevalence in the general population is also low, it's 0.6%, but actually it's twice the prevalence in Mexico. And again, we talked about the fact that there may be, you know, the hypothesis that the migration may represent a possible bridge through which disease can spread into the general population, and particularly among marginalized populations in rural communities. So the question is, okay, condoms Are they the best strategy to prevent HIV infection? We know the answer. Despite what the Bush administration told us, the answer is yes. And we know it's yes, but you have to use them correctly and consistently. People frequently fail to use condoms. And as I said, several studies have shown that migrants' sexual behavior changes when they move to the U.S., and the question is what influenced their decision to use a condom. So our study was, the objective of the study was to analyze condom use among Mexican migrants, returning migrants, and non-migrants. And the hypothesis was that condom use is going to be different in the different contexts between the U.S. and Mexico, and it's going to be a link, it was going to be run by risk perception, by acculturation, by social networks, and by social interaction. So we studied three populations. The first population were migrants from Mexico that went to the U.S., and we studied them in the U.S. The second population were non-migrants, and those we studied in Mexico. And the third population was returning migrants, and those we studied in Mexico. We started with the migrants. There were men between the ages of 18 and 49 who lived in Georgia or worked there for the last 2 months prior to the interview, and they must have had sex in the past 12 months. And the non-migrants were Mexican men born between the ages of 18 and 49 who had never migrated to the U.S. and expressed no intention to do so in the following 2 years. And again, they must have been sexually active in the past 12 months. And finally, returning migrants were the same age group, but they're people that had lived in the U.S. for 6 months or greater and had returned to their home communities in Mexico. They must have had sex in the past 12 months since returning and for more than a year. And our sampling strategy, the first thing we did are randomly selected migrants. We were at the Mexican consulate doing the interviews of migrants while they were waiting for their papers. The Mexican consulate in the U.S. is now one of the busiest consulates of in Atlanta is one of the busiest consulates in the entire United States. For the second stage, for the non-migrants, returning migrants, we went to three communities, and I'll show you why we went to those communities. And we try to balance them in terms of community of origin and community of residence. And in those communities, what we did was a non-probabilistic method, such as a street outreach and snowball sampling. So the field work in Atlanta was conducted between November and early December. This is when you get a lot of migrants going to the consulado because they want to come home for Christmas. And we had a set of interviews that we did, and we did them through ACASI. And basically, this is where we found people, and you can see the state of origin of the migrants that we interviewed in the U.S. in the consulate, and you can see the great majority of them came from three places, Guanajuato, Guerrero, and Hidalgo, and therefore those were the three states that then we came back to Mexico to do the interviews at. And the field work in Mexico, again, these are three maps showing those different states, and, you know, through census tracts, we went exactly to the communities that was indicated to go to. In Guerrero, the field work took place in San Marcos, between March 23rd and April 6, 2009. San Marcos is interesting. San Marcos' migration history began during the 1940s with the Bracero program. And migration rates to the U.S. in San Marcos are really high, especially to Georgia and surrounding states. And in fact, San Marcos is actually known Atlantita. It's not like Little Atlanta in Guerrero. And the municipal and health authorities were very helpful trying to locate these migrants in those communities. And we did some qualitative observation work in which we looked at places where people got health services and where they got condoms, et cetera. Hidalgo, we went to the municipalities of Huesca and Omitán and at Totonilco, and that's where the work was conducted, and you can see the dates. In Guanajuato, we went to that community, and again, they all has to do because that's where the migrants to Georgia come from. Here's the data we collected, and you know we have a lot of data. I'm not going to go all over all of it. And this, again, shows, you know, in those communities how we were using the ACASIs for people to do the interviews. And, again, you have to realize that ACASI works really well. You don't need to be in a highly developed clinic. We were doing ACASIs in a very remote rural site, and people do fine working with computers, and that's one of the things that I think you'd learn very quickly, that it works really well to do it this way. So here are some preliminary results. The qualitative observations show that many men migrate alone. They frequently leave their wife, concubine, or children behind. If you go to many of these communities, especially during the season the men are in the U.S., it's really strange. You see a community that it's all made of women and children. Men are almost nowhere to be found. Many of them migrate without any papers to work in the U.S., and there were a lot of barriers to condom access identified in these communities. And the pharmacies where condoms could be acquired are located far away from the neighborhoods with the highest migration rate. So one of the things you learn is you got to get condoms in places close to where those migrants live, and they're not. So here's the number of interviews we conducted, about, you know, 200 through 300 in each one of them. How many had sex in the past year? It's almost 90%, 80%. You can see where they came from. And who had the percent who did not use a condom? You can see the numbers here. In the non-migrants was 57%, in the returning migrants 70%, in the migrants 61%, and in general was about 63%. More than one sexual partner in the past three sexual intercourses, and you can see the difference in the numbers here, how many had had sex with more than one partner, two partners, etc. And again, what you find is a slightly higher number of partners reported by migrants as opposed to the non-migrants or returning migrants, and especially more than three times having more than three partners, casual partners. And this goes by sexual partner. Did you use a condom? And again, you can see here is in the regular partner, casual partner or steady partner, what the difference in condom use were. Intercourse with commercial sex workers was much higher among migrants than it was among non-migrants and returning migrants. And use of condom among sex workers, again, was actually kind of interesting that, I don't know why this keeps on, continues to change, but anyway, so, sexual intercourse with commercial sex workers was actually pretty high in all groups, but high, significantly high in the migrant group. Intercourse with casual partners, again, higher in migrant populations, but again, condom use was about equal with returning migrants and much lower in the non-migrant population. So what you find is that clearly there's a component of higher condom use in migrants and once they return and much lower when the ones that don't migrate. So basically, at the end, what we find is that there are clearly a lot of barriers to condom use, and condom use with casual partners among returning migrants is comparable to non-migrants. And significant more returning migrants have sex with habitual partners compared with migrants, but condom use was much lower in that group. Also, what's interesting that 8% of returning migrants changed partner in the last 7 days compared to 0% of migrants. So migrants returned to their community and then rapidly, you know, significant number of them changed partners. And opposite pattern was observed with a wider time window. So I think we're beginning to analyze the data, but there are differences in condom use among the groups, differences due to environmental risk perception and personal characteristics, and returned migrants have less sex with casual and commercial sex workers than the ones that stay in the U.S., which is, you know, consistent with previous findings in the literature. But condom use is significantly lower in returning migrants compared to non-migrants, although both groups are similar in regards to context. So there's evidence of a selectivity effect. I think the decision to migrate becomes obviously important in what happens, and evidence of environmental effect where you have the risk perception and the social networks that go into play. And I just want to thank the funders. We got a grant from the Emory Global Health Institute to do this study, and we also had some funding from the Emory Center for AIDS Research and from Fogarty to do this. And the Consulado, I said, was very, very helpful in letting us do the work there. And these are our interviewers who are out in the field doing the work. And I want to end and thank you all for your attention. I don't know if you have any comments, Sergio.
You know, although the theme is AIDS and South-South partnerships, the speakers have some diversity to them. So I thought it would make more sense to have about 5 quick minutes back and forth, rather than wait with your questions for the next hour. So for moderator's prerogative, I'm going to take questions now. So we're going to pass it here, and we'll just go right in order down the rows.
Thanks very much. Wanted to
tell people who you are.
Philippa Easterbrook from the UK. Can you clarify whether you included undocumented, those without documents? Because you mentioned at the start your sampling frame was the consulate.
Yeah.
So surely if the consulate, those without papers wouldn't normally present to the consulate?
Oh, no, absolutely no. The people without papers, actually, they are the most common that go to consulate, because when you go to the consulate, you can actually get something called a tarjeta consular. And a tarjeta consular is an ID card. And for many of them, in Georgia, they cannot get a driver's license. They cannot get any picture ID, but they can get a tarjeta consular. And the counselor the council in many councils, but especially the one in Georgia, has done a terrific job to get the banks and other places to recognize the tarjeta consular as a legal ID, as an official ID. So every migrant wants to get one of those. It's clearly a great way to have a picture ID that makes you legal. I mean, Sergio, you met many of them. I mean, I'm a legal authorized person. I don't have a consular card. I have no reason to have that.
Gosh, what's the advantage of being legal? If you can get most of the benefits from...
No, you can get the benefits. These people cannot get, you know, a lot of the benefits, but they can at least have an ID card that will allow them to go to the bank. And, you know, I mean, how many times you're required to have an ID even to get get through security in an airport? And they can use that as a legal
next,
ID.
Next question. Tell us who you are.
Hi, I'm Brian Montague from Brown University. I have a couple of somewhat related questions. I know in your introduction you had mentioned that the majority of the epidemic out in the rural areas who are migrating seem to be heterosexual transmission. When you actually presented the data on sexual activity once they'd come to the U.S., it was really just presented as far as number of partners. I'm wondering if I'd be correct in presuming that it was still the same male-female sexual partners in the U.S. or whether there's any component of men having sex with men.
So it's you know, sexuality is complicated.
Yeah.
And people don't just decide partners like this. Many of them may have sex with men. They don't consider themselves MSMs, but that's what's available. In some field work we were doing many years ago when I was in Conocida in Watsonville, California, among people who pick up strawberries at the local bar, a male sex worker told me that the difference between a straight Mexican and a gay Mexican was 4 beers. So, you know, that's a phrase they told me. So I think you have to realize that, you know, many of those people may not consider themselves MSMs, but probably have sex with men. We have the data. We just haven't analyzed by who they have sex with. But clearly, again, when you look at the communities, I think the important message for the women is that the highest risk this woman have to get infected with HIV is having sex with their husbands. And I think that's something that you need to realize. Right. The risk is in the husbands who then migrate and then bring HIV home.
And the second somewhat related question is the sexual activity within that community, or is there interchange sexually between the migrant community and other people in the places they're migrating to?
We think that there's the latter. We're doing the social network and sexual network analysis, and we'll be able to know more about that, but I think it's more of the latter.
Last question.
Hola, muy buenas tardes. Soy del Instituto Nacional de Salud Pública. Mi nombre es Ivonne Romero.
Institute of Public Health. My name is Ivonne Romero, and I have 3 specific questions for you. The most important one, you have the right to ask one question. Why did you choose this type of population? Why did you go to these states, Guanajuato, Guerrero, and Hidalgo? Because most of the people who generate
Michoacán
and Zacatecas. We chose those three because in Atlanta is a place where this is where most of the migrants come from, and remember that migration is from community to community. Michoacán is a source of migrants, but most of Michoacán people go to Chicago. In Atlanta we do not have people from Michoacán, but we have lots of people from Guerrero and Guanajuato. So we didn't want to have this bias of interviewing people from different communities to have the same social
context. Very good.
Context.
Thank you.
Muy
excellent.
Bien y gracias. Excelente.
Our next speaker is Neil Nathanson. Neil is a virologist of considerable distinction who's had a wonderful career at the University of Pennsylvania. We were all lucky to have him for a stint at the National Institutes of Health when he headed the Office of AIDS Research, which was responsible for priority setting for the, at that time, more than $2 billion of AIDS funding. Now it's pushing three. And Neil was a breath of fresh air in that office. Although he was a basic scientist, he was incredibly insightful in the broader priorities of prevention research, women's health issues, and global health issues. So it wasn't any surprise to me that in his return to Penn, he's been a leader in global health at Penn, and he's going to describe for us one of the initiatives that he and his colleagues, or mostly he and colleagues from all over the United States and Africa, have taken to build these south-to-south and north-south relations. That's good.
Thank you. So I'm not going to talk about AIDS per se at all. I'm going to talk about a south-south partnership and one that involves Africa. So it's a sort of change from Carlos' talk. It's a different universe.
Okay, so you can change here and you can point here.
Right.
If you, do you want us to change for you?
Yeah.
Okay, you can use the laser if you want. Do you want to point?
Right. So what I'm going to talk to you about is really a vision or a work in progress. It is not an established program, but it does raise a number of issues regarding how one should set up South-South partnerships. And the way this developed, and we have given it a name based on East Africa because that's where most of our African partners come from, and in Swahili, it's Afya Bora Consortium, or for better health. And I won't take the time to go through the Yeah.
Yeah, I'm afraid someone has turned this on.
Yeah, so it's an automatic forward. So
it's alive. We'll keep pushing it back. So go ahead.
Okay, thanks. So it happened that four U.S. institutions had a particular twin partner in Africa. We, with the University of Botswana, folks at UCSF with Muhimbili in Tanzania, and University of Washington with Nairobi, Hopkins with Makerere, and we decided to work together to form a consortium, and I will in a moment explain to you what the consortium is about. So I am basically speaking on behalf of what we call, on behalf of a working group, and these are the folks. So I'm speaking for a large group of folks who are developing this program representing the eight universities. And one thing, it says medical and nursing, so one point about our consortium, and I'll come back to that as I go on, is it is not only for medical young medical professionals, but it's also designed for nursing health professionals. So it's a lot more inclusive than just medical, which I think is one of the significant features. So now, yeah, great. So what's the vision, the general vision? It's to build sustainable capacity for global health in this case, in a set of developing countries. But there are a couple of other things that are important here, at least as far as our vision is concerned. One is that in interviewing many ministries of health or people working in ministries of health or people doing PEPFAR programs in these African countries, and they're all PEPFAR countries, they said that that they had a real shortage of local health professionals who were trained with the practical skills to run major health programs. And yet, there are a lot of major health programs that are not medical center-based because those four countries together, for instance, just to put up a number, receive over $1 billion a year. That's a year. That's not over many years. Each year from PEPFAR. So, and those are obviously population. Yeah, go back, please. Population-based. But we have an eventual goal, which is to build a South-South consortium that can lead the program, not that we wouldn't maintain a network with U.S. universities, but can lead the program on their own, using their combined resources to accomplish something that no one of them could do on their own. So if I can go on to the next. So, and one of the issues that we were trying to address is the following. Universities in Africa and to a great extent in the United States and medical centers tend to be sort of ingrown. That is, they may do a great job of training medical students and residents, but they aren't necessarily terribly engaged with the communities in which they are embedded and, frankly, with the countries which basically fund them in one way or another. And so this was conceived in part to engage those universities in Africa in programs which would reach out to the health issues in their countries. There are a number of things that a university can bring to the table. It's much more sustainable in countries where politicians and even regimes can come and go. It's a good place to recruit young health professional graduates. And then finally, the concept of the consortium, which I've mentioned, which is that a consortium, and I'm talking even about the U.S. institutions, can bring a lot more to the table than any single or even twin relationship. So those are the general concepts. And let's go on to the next slide. The other thing is, we felt we could only train a small number of individuals, so we recognized that to accomplish programs in these countries, there are people, we need health workers at many different levels, and as you know, PEPFAR has now got a goal, although maybe an unrealistic one, of training 140,000 healthcare workers in the 15 PEPFAR countries, but we can only train a small number, so we decided we should focus on training leaders who could organize much larger programs and would have a trickle-down effect and would represent local leadership, in contrast to bringing in expats, which often are running these programs in these four African countries. So that's another part of the concept. And we have had a number of meetings, starting with a meeting in Nairobi in April of 2009, about a year ago. And these are the nurses. And I mentioned one of the emphasis here is the nursing schools and the nursing professional nurses. And as you can see, these are nurses from the eight consortium nursing schools, because each of the institutions happen to have an excellent nursing school as well as a medical school. And that sort of conveys the sense of our all working together in one group. Now, let me go on and say something briefly about the actual program we're talking about. Excuse the confusion here. So we're talking about developing a one-year fellowship, although there are a number of variants. I'll describe that, and I'll mention briefly some of the variants, which would consist of two phases. One would be a set of skill-building modules, and we're not talking about standard knowledge-based courses. And if you look at the list, it gives you a sense. These are to give people who already have a health professional background a set of skills that will at least enable them to develop or manage or evaluate large population-based health programs. And these, I won't list them all, you can read them for yourself, but you can see this is a set of skills, not specifically knowledge, and also by definition, this can be applied to a PEPFAR program, but it also could be applied to dealing with an obesity program or an injury program or traffic accidents, but because all of these are obviously major health issues in our country and in the African countries. Now, the other phase of the program, you can go on to the next one, is what practical work at what we call attachment sites. And we have about, in each country, we have each African country, we've identified about five potential attachment sites. These are sites which have ongoing programs. They could either be PEPFAR, CDC, PEPFAR, USAID, PEPFAR, many NGOs, also international organizations, ministries of health, and some in academic health centers, to provide a variety of training opportunities, but immersion training opportunities, some involving research, some involving operations research and management of programs, some involving education, training, and mentoring. And the thought is that for the trainees to get out as much as they can from these experiences, we would have a mentoring committee, some people on site, some people from our African universities, and some from the U.S., with the goal that each trainee must produce some kind of a work product, not necessarily a scientific paper. It could be a report, but with a specific goal. And also, if you would go back, yeah. Let's just stay here. The other point is that the attachment sites would also be tied to future employment. And I'll come back to that in a moment because, right. Thank you. So at the top I put present or future, possible future employer. So one of the critical things in this kind of a program is it's utterly useless if the people do well in the training and then use that training to leave their country. So the business of retention becomes an important issue, and I'll come back to that in a moment. If I can go on now. So the way we're thinking about this is the 12 months with 4 1-week training modules, 3 weeks of attachment, and so forth, as you can read it. But we also have there are a number of variants on this. One thing that we are emphasizing is that we would set up a network of trainees and mentors that would go on essentially lifelong, which would be a very powerful way of supporting people to continue in their jobs or as they move along in their careers. And secondly, that we might offer for some people a 2-year fellowship with a master's degree, and some individuals will be interested just in the training modules and not in the attachment sites. So we're thinking about a variety because as we've done a lot of work in our African partner countries, and different trainees potentially want different kinds of training opportunities. So we need to have some flexibility. Now, if I can go on to the next. And focuses on the fact that we do have some challenges in this program. And basically what they amount to is there are too many people who want too many things out of the program, and it becomes a challenge to reconcile or harmonize all those different needs and desires and goals. So I'll just list a few of them in the next slide, please. Frankly, one of the issues is we do not have a long-term funding for this, as I mentioned. The potential sponsors may have their own ideas, and those are not necessarily in good synchronization with even the needs of the country, because we've developed this program based on many, many interviews and a lot of interaction with our African partners, but sometimes the sponsors have their own ideas, so I won't go into that in detail, but that's a potential problem. As I mentioned, we need flexibility, and we also need to make sure that these relationships, these training relationships, lead to employment in the country of origin. And so let me go on to the next, and I'll talk about the retention in country and what we've done about that. You know, the next slide. One of them is that some of the trainees will be in service. That is, they will already have a job. They will already have a job, and then they will take a year or part-time to get this training and then continue in that job. Another thing that the African countries have insisted on, interestingly enough, is that anybody coming into this program needs to actually sign a formal commitment to work in country for at least 2 years after completing the fellowship. We are going to use the recruitment process to try to pair future jobs with the trainees, so people coming into this would actually be lined up, if they don't already have a position, with a potential position in country. And also the continuing education, we think, will help people, encourage people to stay in country. If I can go on to the next. So the ultimate question in my mind about whether such a program is going to be useful is whether it will contribute to the health of the population, broadly defined. And let me just finish up in the last slide with what we think are a few of the distinguishing features of this proposed program. If I can see the next one's the last slide. First of all, it's really African-centric, and that is distinct from many traditional programs. That is, the trainees are mainly African. The training will be in Africa, and most of the faculty will be drawn from our African partner institutions. And as I mentioned, the goal is a self-sustaining South-South consortium that can continue this. There'll be a focus on the practical skills, the emphasis on nursing, and finally, something which is clearly needed is additional future leaders, not only for academic health centers, but for population-based health programs in country. So that's the vision that we're now developing and trying to find future funding for. Okay, and I'll be glad to take questions. Thank you.
Thanks, Neil, and we've already got Carlos up here.
So, Neil, that's really great. I think it's wonderful that this is being developed. I think one thing that I would just say, and maybe you're already doing it, but I think one piece of training that I think is sorely needed in medicine, but I think nowhere is more needed than in global health, is how to work as teams and how to collaborate. And, you know, we don't teach that to people. We train them as individuals, and then we throw them into the field and say, oh, you got to work together. And it just doesn't happen. So we need to be sure that people learn how to work within multidisciplinary teams.
Yeah, I completely agree. And the curriculum we're talking about would bring all these people together as a group. So the nursing and physicians and maybe other health professionals would be working together. But also the attachment sites would immerse people in situations, all of which involve working in a team situation, whether it's a Ministry of Health or, you know, other setting like that. So I completely agree.
Yeah, I mean,
with
one
that.
Of the things I thought, for example, to do is something very similar is to have, let's say, have a physician follow a, you know, a manager of a program all day, or have a manager of a program follow a clinician, like a mentoring one-on-one, just to see what kind of problems the other person is facing on their daily lives.
Well, right. And so, you know, so we might assign somebody, or they might work out an assignment to work for 3 months, not, you know, with somebody in a program, and not only contribute, but also see what it's like to negotiate the, you know, the shark-infested waters of a Ministry of Health, let's say, or that kind of thing. So I completely agree with you.
Any other questions? Yeah. Right here. Hold on for a second. And remember to introduce yourself. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Agana. I'm a second-year medical student at UConn. You said when you showed the triangle, you showed, like, the very top, and those are the people you're going to pick. How do you determine who those people are? Are they physicians? Like, who are the leaders? What's your criteria?
Okay, so what we're talking about as a prototype would be young health professionals, people who had gone through medical school and a residency if they came from the medical side, or through nursing school, and perhaps at least the nurses in Africa are telling us they want to select people who already had a master's degree, because the nursing education is more an undergraduate education. But again, we're young, and we're looking to move up in their profession, and who they selected as having potential for leadership. So that's the kind of people we're talking about.
Final question. All right. Thank you, Neil. Philippa Easterbrook is from Great Britain. As she said earlier, she has been working for over a decade at King's College in London as a distinguished professor, both with domestic and international outreach. I've met her in the United States many times when she's consulted for various elements of the NIH. She then moved to the Royal College of Physicians, where she was deeply engaged in international health, and not illogically will be spending probably better than a sabbatical developing new opportunistic infection guidelines for HIV control in developing countries at the World Health Organization. Those guidelines have not been modified in well over a decade, so I think Philippa has her work cut out for her.
Thanks very much, Stan. Is the thing mended yet? Or are you still going to?
It ought to be mended.
It ought to be mended.
You want to control your own destiny?
Yes. So that's.
So that's back, forward, back, and laser.
So that's forward. No, that's forward.
I think that's forward.
That's forward. That's great. Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. And I am going to be speaking in English. I think my sum total of Spanish was 15 pages of the back part of a guidebook that I memorized on a 12-hour flight from London to Lima many years ago. All forgotten now, of course. Well, I know this is the first of a number of sessions at the conference on South-South networks. And so what I'm going to do is to highlight some of the what I believe to be the sort of flagship South-South networks in HIV clinical care, research, clinical trials and surveillance, and to focus on some of their particular strengths and some of the lessons learned, although many of them are in a state of evolution at the moment. And I've deliberately chosen examples from Asia, sub-Saharan Africa, and Eastern Europe, because I know that the Americas and the Caribbean are otherwise well represented at this meeting. And I first just want to acknowledge some of the networks, that I'm going to be presenting: Annette Sohn from Treat Asia, Thomas Narendra from EDCTP, Samila Yaya from Moi University, and Dr. Ying Ru Lo from the WHO. So all of you here will be, I know, familiar and directly involved with North-South partnerships, and there's an abundance of these in sub-Saharan Africa. And I think Uganda probably has a greater concentration of these institutional partnerships per square mile than most. And certainly they've made a major contribution to high-quality research and teaching. But I've discovered another four just from looking at the posters. I think... Back one slide. It's still twitchy.
I'm interrupting. We've got a diagnostic. We have a defective. Oh. It's this thing. So your laser pointer is going to work. The rest is not going to work. So you just say next.
Next. Okay.
We're disconnecting this. We think it's going to.
So verbal. All right. But with their enormous contributions, there have also been well-recognized problems and limitations, and I think some of the most recognized are that in investing and in developing and maintaining these North-South partnerships, it's often at the detriment of the local institution and the national networks and the inevitable power and control and ownership arrangements. Next. Well, in contrast, South-South networks are seen to be a more long-term and sustainable strategy to overcome the problems of the individual institutions through harnessing the sort of collective potentials of the individual institutions, and in particular providing a platform for exchanging country experiences. Next. I should probably put this down. So this is just a quick slide to show you some of the multidisciplinary partnerships, as well as those that are disease-specific, focusing in Africa, that have mushroomed as a result of, I think, particularly the funding agencies deciding to invest less in individual projects and individual institutions and more in supporting networks. Next slide. So the first network I'm going to showcase is a very comprehensive network, Treat Asia, which stands for Therapeutics Research, Education and AIDS Training in Asia. It was founded in 2001, funded by AMFAR, but now with a range of partners based in Bangkok, Thailand, and comprises a network of clinics, HIV clinics, hospitals, research institutions, working importantly with civil society, with the overall aim of seeking to sort of strengthen HIV care, treatment, as well as management skills. Next. So it encompasses, in fact, now 22 pediatric sites, 22 adult sites, as well as lab sites across Asia and the Pacific. Next slide. And I think a particularly unique element and a reason for its success is the synergy between research, education and training, and community activities. And I think it's this synergy that has led to a number of the successful outputs, the knowledge transfer, the improvement in healthcare infrastructure, the better involvement and engagement with governments and the private sector. In terms of the research, there are a number of observational databases that have been set up. This is the first observational database in both adult and pediatric patients across 22 sites, involving about 4,500 adults, similar number of pediatric patients, so addressing questions of natural history in the treated and untreated population. There's also, since 2005, a new initiative with setting up a network for drug resistance monitoring and surveillance, and linked to that is a HIV genotyping quality assurance program. In terms of education, that's very much built on the foundation of the multiple HIV sites, with the development of standardized curriculum and workshops and updates that are held across the region. And on the community side, I think a founding principle of Treat Asia was that effective delivery of ART is best achieved through engagement with civil society, and in particular organizations of HIV-infected individuals. And they have initiated a whole series of community-based treatment literacy, as well as mentorship for community advocates. Next slide. I'm just going to run through some of the sort of south-south successes of the different elements of the program. First, in research, I think one of the important elements is that the data collected by the observational database is owned by the Asian investigators at each of the sites, and all the research is through investigator-led concept sheets. This has led to a number of publications, exchanges between Malaysia and Indonesia on research capacity building. But I think the limited English and some of the scientific writing skills remains a challenge, and certainly from my experience as head of research for a year in at the Infectious Disease Institute in Uganda, I think the one of the sort of critical constraining factors was that sort of high-quality writing skills, both in manuscripts and in internationally competitive grants, is still a deficit. And if there is to be true handing over of the baton in terms of ownership and control to the South, that is important to acquire. Next, please. So just running very quickly in terms of laboratory development, there's been multiple South-South exchanges, particularly in the development of HIV genotyping, Japan to Thailand, Thailand to Malaysia, Taiwan to Indonesia, Taiwan to Papua New Guinea. So true South-South activities. Next. I think this has also led to a genotyping quality control program, which now involves 17 sites in Asia, 3 in Africa, as well as involving the northern partners, Australia and US, in terms of reference labs. Next. For community linkages, there has been a rollout across the sites as a result of community groups exchanging experiences in the integration of people living with HIV and AIDS into clinical care and support teams, with exchanges between Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Cambodia, and importantly China as well. Next. I think you may well say, well, what is the role for a northern, or in this case southern, that's Australia, partner in this now very almost self-sufficient South-South network? Well, I think the very defined role, and it's important to define the role of the Northern Partner, is in data management, biostatistical analysis, and development of the research agenda. And I think this is still very much the case in clinical trials networks, South-South research networks, is the biostatistics data management still very much remains with the Northern Partner. And I think a true test of these partnerships, these South-South partnerships, is when that control and that ownership of the data with large data management facilities in the South finally comes to be. Next. So I'm just going to, how much longer do I have for?
Sorry, I was so interested in your talk, I failed to do my duties as a moderator.
About halfway through?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So in terms of the next network, and I'm just going to have a few slides on each of the next three examples of types of networks. So I think the EDGTP, the European and Developing Countries Clinical Trials Partnership, has been actually quite visionary and forward-looking in the design of its grants programs to be truly South-South. Next slide. So for those of you who aren't familiar with EDCTP, it was set up in 2003 with a main focus on phase 2-3 trials in HIV, TB, and malaria through equal and effective partnership with the African researchers. So there's 17 European countries, 46 sub-Saharan African countries, and the initial commitment, this is up to the end of 2010, they've just competed for the renewal, is 200 million from the European Commission, 200 million from the member states, this is euros, as well as 200 million from matched co-funding sources. Next slide. So in 2007, they introduced for the first time a new clinical trials grant scheme. So it used to be that clinical trials had a separate funding stream to networking grants, but this was the first time they integrated the two. So essentially you now have in these integrated grants the multi-center clinical trial at the center, various networking activities, and then a multitude of different capacity building activities. Next slide. And an example of this is a trial, the Ernest trial of second-line therapy that we're just about to randomize the first patient to, involving no longer South Africa, but Zimbabwe, Malawi, and Uganda, with a lot of capacity-building activities. So investing in, built round a trial, capacity-building activities that will allow, hopefully, the site to be sustainable in the future. Next slide. However, I think this approach to funding clinical trials is does not fully address all of the issues and challenges, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. The fact that there's still a problem of critical mass, that many of the researchers work in isolation, and there's still not much sharing of expertise and facilities. And I know, speaking to my colleagues in Uganda, they say they know more about what's happening in the States or Europe than they do about what's happening down the road in Kenya. And so South-South mentorship programs are still weak. Next slide. So this new scheme is funding four regional sites in South Africa, West, Central, South, and East, as networks of excellence, with 2.5 million euros initially as seed funding, to be a platform for clinical trials, South-South mentorship, and capacity building. Next. So the key objective is to promote and coordinate inter-regional collaboration, to implement South-South mentorship, and to make those networks competitive for future funding, and not to forget about continuing to build and hone North-South collaborations. Next. So this is an example of the East African one. There was actually a bit of a merger and acquisition of another partnership, so it's now bigger than it was initially. Involving sites all across East Africa, but including Rwanda, Ethiopia, and Sudan now, and linking strong institutions in Africa with weaker ones. And we have a whole series of activities planned for the next few years. And this one's led by Pontiano Kalibu, based at MRC Uganda. Next slide. So just quickly, a few slides on some other examples. So we've dealt with sort of a comprehensive network, clinical trials. This is the ANPATH academic model for the provision of access to healthcare in Western Kenya. 3 minutes. next slide. And this is an example of a network that grew from a more traditional north-south partnership between Indiana University and Moi, and then gradually evolved over the course of time. I think the catalyst was the PEPFAR funding, into a south-south regional network, now involving 18 clinics and 8 satellite sites with more than 100,000 patients enrolled. Next slide. And I think out of necessity, from its expanded structure, it grew from the more traditional sort of two-way traffic between the central ANPATH site in Eldoret, peripheral clinics, them contributing information and specimen, drugs and supplies going in the other direction, next slide, to a much more hub-and-spoke model. And this is the sort of transitioning model that's happening at the moment. Next slide. And I think there have been many successes, and probably the key one is just the sheer numbers of patients that are now accessing therapy, a research program, a training program, as well as lab development. Skip over the next slide, and the next one, and the next one. Sorry. So I'm just going to finish now by just mentioning the WHO Knowledge Hubs. I certainly wasn't aware of their existence until I started to work with the WHO. Next slide. And these Knowledge Hubs are basically where WHO has designated certain regional institutions to act as regional resources for capacity building and training activities and providing technical assistance. Next slide. And so this is just some examples. There are actually five in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. For example, there's one in Lithuania that's focusing on harm reduction, development of toolkits, training of staff, running workshops. Next slide. And I think also important, because we forget in HIV, that there is an important epidemic in also the Middle East and North African countries, in part or largely driven by injecting drug use. And so there have been three hubs established in, I think, Lebanon, Morocco, and also Iran. And Iran is then servicing Iraq, Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and building a network in the region. Fine. Next slide. And next slide. I'm going to skip over this one. And just the final slide. Actually, just to mention in terms of these WHO networks and knowledge hubs, I mean, sustainability remains an issue with all these networks. And I think an interesting sort of twist is that I've certainly heard from sort of colleagues at the WHO that the collaborating universities are really becoming quite savvy to a business model and actually charging for their time and for their technical assistance. And this is a financial challenge. But I think what remains unresolved is how to monitor the performance of these different networks. And I think the final slide, which I think is more for discussion later on, just the final slide, I've really just cut and pasted some of the sort of features of success of these different networks. This could apply to a north-north, north-south network. Many of the same principles apply. But I think is really going to be very important for the future is how to measure the performance of these networks, and maybe these are some points we can revisit later. Thanks.
We do have time for a question. Is there a question? I might say, you know, the monitoring of the impact of the network. You have very obvious metrics, how many publications, how many successful projects, even measuring that can be tricky. Speculate for us what some of your ideal metrics are for the success of a network. Sort of that last slide, that last line.
Yeah. Can I have that last slide back, actually? Yeah, or maybe that's too difficult. No. Sorry, it's complicated. Well, I think, as you say, there are the traditional ones, MSc students, PhDs, postdoctoral fellowships. I think it's just the very last slide. I think the issue of its durability. Sorry, there were just four points I wanted to... This one. Next one. Fine. I think the issue of sustainability, cost effectiveness has not really been evaluated. And impact, I think, as we move now more into a information science approach and impact on clinical care, national government policies, incorporation of findings from studies into those approaches. This is an evolving science at the moment, how to evaluate these.
Good. Excellent. All right. Thank you, Filippa. That was a lot of material. All right. We save our host for last. Thank you. INSP is hosting us, and Sergio Bautista gets to speak twice, first through Carlos and now through himself. And you'll see his point there. He has worked on HIV, he's worked on breast cancer,
cost-effectiveness, efficiency of public health programs. He's worked on outcomes research, migration, and has worked with too many partners to count, including Emory and including World Bank. So with that brief introduction, we'll let you dive in.
Thank you, sir. I think I'll change the pattern through this session, and I'll switch to Spanish, if you don't mind. The slides are in English, so you can follow easily. Well, the work I'm going to present here is, I think, a very interesting collaboration. It's not only South-South, but it has a very strong South-South component. But it includes not only the Rwandan Ministry of Health and the School of Public Health in Rwanda, but also the World Bank and the University of California in Berkeley. And I will present here the design of this evaluation. What is it that we are evaluating? I think it's a very interesting experience, and focusing on HIV. And I will present some very preliminary analysis on the baseline data that we have. Bueno, voy a cambiar a español ahora.
Into Spanish. Something very fast about Rwanda's introduction in general terms. 9 million people in terms of health. It is divided into 30 different administrative districts, and there is more information. In terms of the size of the health system, it is not a very large country. As you can see, there are 33 second and third level hospitals, and then 370 first level basic clinics, and this is basically the health system with which Rwanda is facing health problems. At the beginning of the 2000, there was a very important effort. There was a very important effort made in Rwanda, where an analysis was made to determine the main challenges that were faced at that moment and how we should plan a mid and long-range strategy in order to face it. There we have the diagnosis of this analysis, and there were health typical problems in the region in terms of maternal mortality and HIV, maternal and HIV and child mortality, and another very important problem that doesn't only happen in Rwanda but in the region has to do with the retention of human capital in order to face health problems, physicians and nurses, a very serious problem because only a little supply of this type of professionals, and amongst those that were already there, an important problem that has to do with motivation and satisfaction with work. So this gave place to this response. The objective of the program had to do with health results, HIV, but it should also have an important component in terms of motivating staff and to increase retention levels of the staff at hospitals and clinics in Rwanda. So the idea that came out of it is what the government called the PBF, the Performance-Based Financing Program. And here we have the general characteristics of the problem of the program. The objective is to increase both the quantity and the quality of medical services. The program has two components. One is focused on general health, and basically it is focused in maternal and child mortality, and then we also have the HIV component. These are the two major areas. A very important objective has to do with increasing the motivation of the staff and to reduce the rotation or the turnover, at least outside of the country, through economic incentives, payments that were economic incentives in order to motivate, not only to increase the satisfaction and to increase motivation and to improve performance. It is a very sophisticated system that works through contracts between the Ministry of Health and the different financing agencies, all the way to the clinic level. At an individual level for each clinic, there is a contract and there is a specific supervision at this level. This exercise was started in the year 2001 in Rwanda in a couple of districts just to explore the feasibility of the scheme, of the mechanism, to determine whether or not it could work, how the staff was to embrace it. And in the year 2001-2002, these projects were implemented in a couple of regions in Rwanda. In the year 2005, it was bigger and bigger, and after that we were thinking how to implement the program at the largest scale across the country, and together with the program implementation to integrate an impact evaluation program in order to have results of this program. The model that we finally implemented across the country, as I said, are two levels. One, which is more focused on maternal and child models and HIV, on the other hand, and it basically works as follows. There are indicators in each one of these areas, and they measure the performance of the clinics, and then clinics on a monthly basis have to report how they did the performance of that specific month, and then based on the report they are going to be giving with money with a specific price for each one of these indicators. So based on what they produced, they are given additional money at the end of the trimester. They can work at the clinic level. These economic incentives that they are given based on the performance will also have a quality component. Each trimester, there is a group of external supervisors who come to the clinic with a list that they review, and they check. And this is basically focused on measuring the structural quality of clinics, and this is part of the report of the product service production, and then there is a correction of the produced amount. So what they make at the end of the trimester is the result of the number of services they produced with a price, and this is a value that is weighted by a quality factor. So if quality was 50% according to the review, they are going to be given only 50% of what they would receive for that service production. So we have these two components, and together will represent the payment clinics are made. And as I said, I will be talking about the impact assessment that is part of this program. Basically, we took advantage of the expansion rollout program because it was not enough to work in the year 2006 with all clinics across the country, and we decided we had the opportunity to decide which were going to be implemented in the year 2006 and in the ones in the year 2008 to help the impact assessment. And according to this, this is how the districts are divided based on these characteristics, the rainfall, the population, and there were pairs of districts. The members of these pairs were going to be assigned to control treatment randomly, and in this way we had an experimental design at the district level, and it allowed us to do impact assessment. This is how the districts are distributed. The white ones are the stage zero. These are the districts that started before that, and this is not included in the phase one and phase two. Those are the ones in the year 2008. Another important part of this assessment, of this impact assessment, which is very important, is that we were interested in making the difference of the effect of having economic incentives to improve the performance and to have additional monies in the clinic, because obviously the more resources in the clinic could also affect the results of the health results. And it was very important to distinguish these two. And we work as follows. Clinics that were not yet in the program, the stage two, were not given, they were not part of the incentive, performance incentive program, but they were given the average every trimester of additional resources of the ones that were included in the performance program. With this design, we were able in these two groups to have an additional resource flow. It was more or less the same, but in stage one, there was this additional resource flow related to performance as part of the program, and in this way the effects we see out of this program are not because of the additional number of resources of the clinics, but because these resources were conditioned to the performance of the clinics. The next one, please. In the year 2005-2006, we did basal interviews. We have clinic 11 and household surveys. And these are, first I'll be speaking about the clinic level, the facility level. These are the hypotheses we're interested on. Obviously, we want to know if there is an increase in our service provision in quality as well as in quantity. And we also want to measure a very important part, which is to test, to make sure those services which are not related to performance should not be displaced or taken out by those services which are related to performance. This is something we are also measuring because we want to see what is the change in the service composition. While there is an increase in performance-related services, we don't want to have negative effects on others. The next one, please. This is very fast information, and I will quickly talk about the basal surveys. Here we have the composition of the staff in clinics. Most of them are nurses, like in many other African places. This is a composition in terms of the responsibility, the time they devote to specific activities, HIV. This tells us if the staff has a specific training in order to be to take care of these activities. It is a pretty well-trained staff. The next one, please. Here we have some important messages. And apart from this questionnaire that we did at the clinic level, we also applied clinical vignettes to our service providers to measure their knowledge, facing hypothetical cases on paper, and they were to they had to respond to the situations. What would they do in these hypothetical cases? We also did exit polls with our patients, and these instruments were focused on three types of HIV-related services: provision of antiretrovirals, obesity. PNCTC, vertical transmission. Here we have some results of the exit polls with patients, the age, the service. What we did was the following. When a person is out of the clinic, we were asking them, why did you go to the clinic? Did you go because of any of these reasons? We applied the interview, the survey. We were asking about characteristics, about the visit they just made to the clinic, to know the type of service they were getting. an important aspect that we can also use to assess the service quality has to do with how patients perceive the service they were given. And what is very interesting about these results is that a big, big portion of patients are satisfied or very satisfied with the services they were given, and there is almost no chance to improve. And when we see the responses in the exit interviews, when we were asking about the specific characteristics and services, and we see the results are not that high, there is good performance in some very important areas, but there are also characteristics in the interviews which are not that well covered or included. For example, this is very interesting. This is a section relative to the history of the patient that is going to have a detection test. And here we can see a very low level of how much physicians see the important characteristics related to the contact of people. There is no exploration, there is no examination of important aspects related to detection. And this is VCT as well, VCT, but during the consultation, during the visit to the physician. This is during the exit interview. It is difficult to improve, but there are lots of space in terms of performance of physicians in order to improve after the intervention. At the household level, obviously the most important result we are interested in assessing has to do with the health condition of HIV people. I will show you how the sample was taken, and we also wanted to know whether or not there were additional effects to improve the condition of HIV patients. What is going to be the relationship of the social and economic level in general terms? What is going to be the influence on this specific patient? Obviously, we also want to know the characteristics related to compliance of antiviral medications. And another important element has to do with the research, knowing that if there is better quality and if there is more access to to the medication. Let's see what is going to be the result. These are the characteristics that we measure in the household questionnaire. And here in HIV, in terms of the size of the sample in households, almost 2,500 individuals, 1,500 are HIV patients. And we did the following. In order to have the sample, in order to have this patient sample, we oversampled on purposely the number of HIV patients, and then we went to the clinic. We did so by going to the clinic, and we chose those places where we knew there was an HIV patient in each district, and in this way we have a pretty high sample. Here we have the analysis of the balance, the baseline between these two groups, treatment and control. Here the experiment worked pretty well. A great many variables can be perfectly well compared with the different groups, with these two groups. And here we have some interesting analysis. If we compare the HIV patients and the sample of non-HIV patients, if people had trouble to have access to their transportation to go to work, the time they spent in trying to get medical services, very high numbers, the presence of cases of death in their homes in the last 5 years. And here we have expenses related to treatment. In transportation terms, transportation is a very important element of costs that homes face in Rwanda when they look for medical service. The time they spend trying to have transportation and having access to medicine, and the perception of their qualities of life, it is very low compared in the patients group compared to non-patient groups. There are different ways of asking about depression levels and satisfaction levels, and they have even less sexual activity, but those who have more sexual activity, they more frequently use condoms. We finished our surveys, follow-up surveys in the year 2008. Then the program was went to all the stage 2 programs in the year 2009. Now we have this intervention across the country, and I would like to now share with you some final thoughts. One very important characteristic of this Rwanda impact assessment is that this is an assessment with an experimental design that would allow us to credibly measure the impact of the results we are interested on, and we do this not at the level of a small pilot program at controlled clinics, at a very large level in many districts. 50% of the country is the one that is subject to this assessment. And another interesting element has to do with the fact that we do not only measure those variables related to the process of this service provision, but it is also related to many health results, biological health results, which are measured among the different individuals. This is it. Thank you very much.
Hay preguntas. Y yo tengo una pregunta muy obvio, si una clínica está haciendo un trabajo.
If a clinic is doing a very bad job, and if there's going to be no more financing for that clinic, it would be much better to improve, wouldn't it? Or is the clinic going to continue working incorrectly? So by increasing are you improving quality and quantity? The payment works as follows. There is a basic financing for wages and for inputs, and this is not related to performance, and this will never change. It is the additional compensation, the additional monies, the one that is related to performance. The basic is guaranteed, but if they want to make more above the basic financing, that is exactly what is going to be related to performance and the impact results that we are publishing, not in HIV, but maternal and child health. Those are very positive numbers. Sergio, this is very interesting, and I remember that in the United States, Medicare is paying based on performance and or lack of payment for non-performance, so it is going to be exactly the opposite. And the problem behind these systems is that many times people find a way to gain the system, because money is an incentive for the clinic, and when you have limited resources, this is very important, and there is going to be an impact, and it could bring resources. People will go to where the monies are, and if you are paying for these AIDS quality indicators, but if you do not give this for the treatment of maternal and health, maternal health, how can you control this? Because people will go to where the monies are. Well, at least in the case of Rwanda, and yes, there are many experiences in many other places in the United Kingdom. There are many experiences where patients are chosen. The ones that have the best life and the best condition. In Rwanda, we did the following. First, all the indicators that were used at the end are related not to the health condition of the person. They are related to the process to determine if the requirements were met. And obviously, the condition of the patient is not amongst these requirements. Another thing is that there is an external auditing system, and randomly the system will go to different clinics in order to measure and to see the records and to determine if the reports they made are true. and the clinics are randomly selected. You can never know when they are coming to your clinic, and there are also patients who are chosen randomly, and they are reported patients, and they go to their homes and they ask these patients, did you go on this date to the clinic to be given these services? And I believe the system is working pretty well.
Bueno, algunas experiencias en el pasado nos han enseñado que si pones el incentivo en
if
el estado
you
de salud,
have the incentive, the health fuerte, conditioner status, it is going to be a very important incentive just for choosing, for selecting patients, so it wouldn't be convenient because those who are facing the very terrible situations will be left outside of the process.
Interesting and impressive. Could you just tell us something about how this collaboration came about? And is performance-based funding integrated into the Mexican healthcare system?
Those are very good questions. Well, first, this collaboration started because this is when in 2006 this program was funded, in 2005 when this program was funded, a large component of the funding came from the World Bank. And at that time, Paul Gertler, who's a close collaborator with INSP, was in the World Bank as chief economist of the Human Development Network. So through that collaboration was that the University of California, Berkeley, and the National Institute of Public Health in Mexico start working with the Rwandan School of Public Health to design this evaluation and collaborate in this evaluation. I have to say that working with the School of Public Health in Rwanda, I mean, they have come to Mexico a couple of times. We've been there many times. It's been a really interesting experience. And in some ways, this collaboration has now taken its own way, independent of the World Bank and the University of California. We have now projects in common that came because of this initial collaboration. The second question was
about whether it's been integrated. This is routine
no,
in Mexico.
Not now. Mm. We have, at least some of us here at INSP, have talked to the Ministry of Health a couple of times, trying to convince them to at least start thinking about it or starting a pilot in a region in Mexico, at least for some specific outcomes, but we have not been successful yet.
Gracias, Sergio.
De nada.
So this brings us to the close of the session, and I just don't know if everybody in the room appreciates how unusual these four talks have been. You heard from Carlos Del Rio about cross-border research that involved within country, within Mexico, collaborations in three states, involved two different populations in Mexico, non-migrants and returning migrants, and then a sort of index group of migrants in the United States and how that was cross-referenced. Very, very creative stuff and very unusual research. You heard from Neil Nathanson about an ambitious South-South-North partnership. South because they're trying to link these four African universities that can continue to play off each other's strengths and correct each other's weaknesses far beyond the American universities' involvement, but at the present time, four American universities partnering as well, and the wide swath of activities that they have. You heard from Professor Easterbrook, Philippa, describing the Treat Asia Network, this very ambitious and very exciting, relatively new collaboration that reminded me a little bit of the HIVNAT as well, which the Aussies and the Dutch did with Thailand. But this is multi-country, even more ambitious than HIVNAT. And then she described at least four networks and partnerships in Africa, one in the Middle East on harm reduction, the unusual WHO network, and highlighting some of the work going on in the in Eastern Europe. And what's especially exciting there is looking at these tremendous investments in clinical trials and cross-site research capacity building, and she was very honest about where some of that capacity building hasn't really transferred yet to the developing countries, and she, by implication, she said where she would want to pay more attention. And then Sergio wrapped it up, Dr. Bautista, with a really inspiring south-to-south collaboration where you didn't hear the word USA or Canada or Australia or any of the European countries. They weren't necessary. The expertise, the innovation was coming from the Rwandans. The expertise for the evaluation was coming from the Rwandan-Mexican partners. And you found this finance-based program evaluation tackling one of the most difficult challenges in developing countries, namely, how do we incentivize quality? How do we incentivize staying on the job if you're a good healthcare worker? How do we make sure the Rwandans don't migrate to Kenya or anywhere else, or France for that matter, or Belgium? How do we keep people in their jobs who are doing an excellent job, and how do we measure that? Now, if anybody's got something more important than that in the modern, you know, global health marketplace, I'd like to hear it, because he's tackling at many levels the health manpower issues that beleaguer us and plague us. So, and I loved Philippa's question about, well, has Mexico paid any attention to this? Maybe we need it here. And we could have said that about the U.S. of A. Anyway, I think we're in a marvelous place here after the four presentations. I just wanted to point out, I did a project in with my graduate student and colleagues in Zambia a few years ago in which we asked a very simple, you asked, does this performance-based contracting reduce other services in the health sector? And we asked the question in PMTCT programs, does the addition of a service HIV program or a research HIV program, or sometimes both, does that reduce non-HIV services? In other words, do you hemorrhage the attention of your health system and your health workers such that you actually neglect something? And our marker condition was syphilis, syphilis screening and antenatal care. And much to my bitter disappointment, we found that research had no impact, service made syphilis testing worse, and only when you added the resources of a service and a research project did you actually improve syphilis screening. So I found, to my horror, that our program was actually siphoning energy, resources, and quality from antenatal care in general into the HIV program, which is the opposite of what my hypothesis was. It made me a very humble person. So on that note, I'd like to thank all the speakers, and I think you've been in for a real treat this afternoon.